In 1796, George Washington published his farewell address. It wasn't just a goodbye letter, it was a desperate warning. He wrote that political parties, if left unchecked, would become, quote, potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people. He predicted a system where alternate factions would seek revenge on each other, leading to a frightful despotism. He wasn't talking about policy disagreements, he was talking about a structural hijacking of the Republic. Today, we are looking at the machinery behind that hijacking. We often hear that America is divided because we simply disagree on the issues. But what if that division isn't a symptom of democracy, but a product of engineering? What if the gridlock, the anger, and the paralysis are actually the intended results of a system redesigned to consolidate power? To help me disassemble this machine, I'm joined by Alex.
Washington's foresight was terrifyingly accurate. We aren't just dealing with a difference of opinion anymore. We are living through what political scientists call affective polarization. It means the defining feature of American politics isn't that we love our own side, it's that we despise the other. And as we will discuss, that hatred has been monetized, strategized, and weaponized by specific actors for specific gains.
Let's start with that word weaponized. It implies intent. A lot of people feel like this polarization is just a natural cultural drift. We watch different movies, we live in different places, so we vote differently. You were suggesting this was, at least in part, a deliberate architectural decision.
Cultural drift is real, but the architecture exploits it. If you want to find the blueprints for the modern division, you have to look at the realignment that began in the 1960s and solidified in the 80s and 90s. Before this period, the American parties were much more ideologically messy. You had conservative Democrats in the South and liberal Republicans in the Northeast. That overlap forced compromise.
But that overlap also obscured deep injustices. The conservative Democrats in the South were the architects of Jim Crow. So when that realignment happened, when the parties sorted themselves into clear ideological camps, wasn't that actually clarifying? It gave voters a clearer choice.
It offered clarity, yes, but it also opened the door for the Southern strategy. This is where the intentionality becomes undeniable. In 1981, Republican strategist Lee Atwater gave an interview that was later released by The Nation. He explained the evolution of political signaling. He described how in 1954 you could use explicit racial slurs. By 1968, that backfires, so you switch to talking about states' rights or forced busing. Then by the 1980s, you get even more abstract, talking about tax cuts or economic erosion.
He essentially admitted to abstracting racism into economics to maintain a coalition.
Precisely. Atwater's point was that you could maintain a division based on identity and resentment without ever using the explicit language that would alienate moderate voters. This was a strategy to build a winning coalition by fusing cultural grievance with economic policy. It turned the parties into what Ezra Klein, in his book Why We're Polarized, calls super identities. Your political party isn't just about tax rates anymore. It's about your race, your religion, your geography, and your culture. When those things stack up perfectly, compromise feels like a betrayal of your very self.
That psychological stacking explains the anger, but it doesn't explain the paralysis. Washington warned about cunning men subverting power. How does this emotional division translate into the mechanical hijacking of the government? Because right now, it feels like neither side can actually govern.
Gridlock is a feature, not a bug, for the people currently benefiting from the status quo. To understand the mechanics, we have to look at the primary system and gerrymandering. These are the two pinchers squeezing the center out of American politics. Let's look at gerrymandering first. The Supreme Court effectively washed its hands of partisan gerrymandering in Rucco v. Common Cause in 2019, stating it was a political question, not a legal one. This gave the green light to advanced mapping software that allows politicians to pick their voters with surgical precision.
I've seen the maps. They look like Rorschach tests. But both parties do this. In Maryland, Democrats have drawn aggressive maps. In Texas and North Carolina, Republicans have done the same. If everyone is doing it, isn't it just a wash?
The result might balance out in terms of total seats nationally, but the effect on the representative is where the hijacking happens. This is the technical breakdown. If you are a congressman in a district that has been packed to be D plus 20 or R plus 20, you have zero fear of losing the general election to the other party. Your only threat is a primary challenge from your own flank. If you compromise, if you reach across the aisle, you are primaried for being a traitor. This pushes every candidate to the extreme edges to survive the primary, leaving the general electorate with two radical choices. The structure incentivizes radicalism.
So the politician acts rationally to save their job, but the systemic outcome is irrational extremism. It reminds me of the prisoner's dilemma in game theory. Individually, they are making the safe bet, but collectively, they are blowing up the house.
That's a perfect analogy, and this brings us to the next layer of the hijacking, the media landscape. We cannot talk about intentional division without discussing the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987. Before 1987, holders of broadcast licenses were required by the FCC to present controversial issues of public importance and to do so in a manner that was honest, equitable, and balanced. If you aired a conservative view, you had to provide time for a liberal counterargument.
And the argument for repealing it was that it stifled free speech and that the market would provide diversity.
Which was a catastrophic miscalculation of market incentives. Once the Fairness Doctrine was gone, talk radio exploded. Rush Limbaugh went national in 1988. 1 year later, he didn't have to offer balance. He could offer pure, uncut validation of his audience's grievances. This proved that outrage is a far more profitable commodity than nuance. Cable news followed suit in the 90s, and then the internet accelerated it. The business model shifted from broadcasting, trying to reach the widest audience with a moderate message, to narrow casting, capturing a specific demographic and keeping them addicted through fear and anger.
This brings up the concept of negative partisanship you mentioned earlier. The data on this is staggering. Pew Research has tracked this for decades. In 1994, fewer than 20% of Republicans and Democrats viewed the other party as a threat to the nation's well-being. By 2014, those numbers had skyrocketed. We aren't voting for our candidate. We are voting to stop the monster on the other side.
And that fear is the ultimate control mechanism. If I can convince you that the other side is an existential threat to your way of life, that they're going to destroy your church or take your freedom or ruin the planet, then I can get away with anything. I don't have to deliver good policy. I don't have to fix the roads or improve healthcare. I just have to be the shield against them. This is how the political class hijacks the voter. They trade performance for protection.
But Alex, if the system is so paralyzed, who is actually winning? You mentioned cunning men earlier. If Congress can't pass laws, how does anyone benefit? It seems like a failed state, not a hijacked one.
Paralyzing is profitable for the status quo. If you're a massive corporation enjoying a favorable tax loophole or an industry avoiding regulation, gridlock is your best friend. A Congress that cannot pass legislation is a Congress that cannot regulate you. Furthermore, there is an entire political industrial complex, consultants, ad agencies, pollsters, media conglomerates, that generates billions of dollars in revenue from this perpetual war. The 2020 election cycle saw nearly $14 billion in spending. That money goes somewhere. It goes to the people manufacturing the division.
Let's dig into the digital aspect of this manufacturing. We talked about talk radio, but the algorithmic era seems to have put this on steroids. I was reading a study published in Science recently where researchers paid people to stop using Facebook for a month. The result was that their factual knowledge of news went down, but their partisan animosity also dropped significantly. It implies that being informed in the modern sense actually just means being inflamed.
That distinction between informed and inflamed is vital. Social media algorithms are optimized for engagement, and high arousal emotions, specifically moral outrage, drive the most engagement. This is the attention economy.
If a platform shows you a nuanced discussion on tax policy, you scroll past. If it shows you a video of a crazy person from the other party doing something offensive, you stop, you comment, you share. The algorithm learns to feed you the worst examples of the other side. This creates a false reality, where we believe the other side is entirely composed of their most extreme 5%.
So we are hallucinating our enemies. We are fighting a caricature generated by code.
Exactly. And this connects back to the intentionality. The platforms know this. The whistleblower Francis Haugen released documents showing Facebook knew their algorithms promoted divisiveness but prioritized growth. That is a choice. That is a hijacking of human psychology for profit.
I want to challenge the mastermind theory a bit here. You've laid out how Atwater, the media moguls, and the tech giants built this. But isn't there a risk that we are giving them too much credit? Newt Gingrich, for example, in the 1990s, definitely accelerated polarization in the House by refusing to socialize with Democrats and using very specific demonizing language. But eventually, the base he fired up turned on the establishment. We saw this with John Boehner getting pushed out and later Paul Ryan. It looks less like a controlled demolition and more like they built a Frankenstein's monster that broke out of the lab.
That is a fair critique. It's the tiger riding problem. You can ride the tiger of populism and rage for a while, but eventually it gets hungry. Gingrich's contract with America in 1994 nationalized local elections and turned the Speaker of the House into a prime minister-style figure of opposition. He proved you could win by breaking the norms of civility. But you are right. The forces unleashed by that strategy have now consumed the architects. The elites may have started the fire to clear the field, but now the wildfire is burning down their own mansions. However, just because they lost control doesn't mean the division wasn't manufactured. It just means the manufacturing process was volatile.
Is there a structural way out? We have Duverger's law, which states that winner-take-all election systems naturally tend toward two parties. As long as we have first-past-the-post voting, are we mathematically doomed to this binary cage match?
Duverger's law is the mathematical cage, yes. In a winner-take-all system, voting for a third party is strategically essentially a vote for the candidate you like least because you are splitting the coalition. This is why structural reformers talk about ranked choice voting or open primaries. Alaska recently implemented a top four primary system with ranked choice voting. In 2022, it resulted in the defeat of Sarah Palin and the election of a moderate Democrat, Mary Peltola, in a red state, simply because the system rewarded broad appeal rather than base mobilization.
And naturally, the partisan machines hate that. There are lawsuits and campaigns across the country right now trying to ban ranked choice voting.
Because it threatens the duopoly's business model. If you force candidates to appeal to the median voter, the industry of outrage collapses. You can't run a campaign based solely on the other guy is a demon if voters can rank a second choice who is less demonizing.
We've covered the history, the tech, the money, and the maps. But I want to land on the cultural impact. What does this do to a society long term? We aren't just talking about stalled bills in Congress. We are talking about a society where we don't trust our neighbors.
It destroys the concept of a shared reality. When polarization becomes this deep, facts themselves become partisan markers. If Team Blue says the economy is good, Team Red must say it's bad, regardless of the GDP data. This erosion of truth is the precursor to authoritarianism. As Hannah Arendt warned, the ideal subject of totalitarian rule isn't the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction no longer exists. By fragmenting our reality, the division machine paves the way for leaders who claim that they alone are the source of truth.
It's a sobering thought. We started with Washington's warning about frightful despotism, and we've arrived at Arendt's warning about the end of truth. The thread connecting them is the intentional manipulation of human tribalism.
The optimistic take, if I can try to find one, is that these are mechanical problems. Gerrymandering is a map problem. Primaries are a rules problem. Algorithms are a code problem. These are things that were built, which means they can be dismantled.
It is not an act of God that we hate each other. It is a result of specific incentives. If we change the incentives, open the primaries, unrig new maps, regulate the algorithmic amplification, the behavior will change.
But that requires the people benefiting from the system to vote against their own interests. Or it requires a public that is aware enough to demand it.
And that is the hard part. The system is designed to exhaust us, to make us check out. The ultimate victory of the hijacking is when the average citizen says, "It's all corrupt, I'm not participating." That apathy is the cement that holds the wall in place.
So the most rebellious thing you can do is refuse to be manipulated, to recognize when your outrage is being farmed for profit, to look at the enemy and realize they are likely just as trapped in their algorithmic silo as you are in yours.
Exactly. We have to stop being the fuel for their engine.
We have covered a lot of ground today, from the Southern strategy to the algorithm. The takeaway is clear. The division is real, but the intensity of it is manufactured. It's a product sold to us in exchange for our power. If you found this conversation valuable, if it helped you see the strings on the marionette, please send this episode to a friend who feels burned out by politics. It might be the explanation they've been looking for.